This is the new Weight Watchers, built for real life and real results, no matter what mode you're in. Maddie went all in for her big day and lost 33 pounds. Emily lost 85 pounds and hit her goal while still living her life.
Weight Watchers gave me the tools and I feel amazing.
Join the millions of members and lose weight with the number one doctor-recommended weight loss program. Lose more at weightwatchers.com.
At 6 months, participants in a clinical trial of Weight Watchers program lost an average of 12 pounds.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable. This episode of the Sportsman's Empire is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. Since 1952, Interstate Batteries has been evoking compassion and a trustworthy spirit into the surrounding communities. Interstate Batteries is a mission-driven company fueled by purpose and guided by their values. If you need help locating a specific battery, stop into your local Interstate Batteries retail store and speak with a battery specialist. They even offer cell phone repairs. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
We're leaving today and entering a world of Mickey Mouse waving, princess meeting and greeting, lightsaber clashing, the Twilight Zone Tower of Terror dropping, Banshee flying, Space Mountain launching, galaxy rewinding, what is the whole deck of galaxy rewinding, fireworks igniting, world of other worlds. For whatever you love, infinite worlds await at the most magical place on Earth, Walt Disney World Resort.
From athletic stuff like a full court pickup game, swish, to athletic-ish stuff like a half mile stroll. Get those steps in. Head to Sierra or Sierra.com for the brands you want at the prices that let you do it all. From athletic to athletic-ish, Sierra's got it.
Two Good & Co. coffee creamers are made with farm fresh cream, real milk, and contain 3 grams of sugar per serving. That's 40% less than the 5 grams per serving in leading traditional coffee creamers for a rich, delicious experience. Whether you enjoy your coffee hot, cold, bold, or frothy, Two Good coffee creamers make every sip a good one. Two Good coffee creamers, real goodness in every sip. Find them at your local Kroger in the creamer aisle.
All right, everybody, this is the Western Rookie Podcast. I'm your host, Dan Johnson. And today, dude, I'm giving you a label, Ben, all right? And that label, and if you're watching this on YouTube, you can tell by the number, the amount of bone he has hanging on the wall behind him. Ben Guttormson is a slayer, okay? You're a slayer, dude. So, Ben, it's been a long time since we've talked. Thanks for taking time out of your day to hop on the podcast, man.
No, absolutely. It's good to catch up, man.
Yeah, I know for sure.
We kind of went back and forth for, it seems like, several weeks here trying to connect.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. It's harder to get people on these days, especially, I mean, even for me, like, to narrow me down for something outside of my daily routine. Because how many kids you got now?
I got two kids.
Two kids. I got three. We both have, you know, we're both running businesses or having full-time jobs or things like that. It just, dude, it's just harder. Life is harder now.
Yeah. No, it's finding that just downtime you know, and it seems like the schedule fills up rather quickly for sure.
Right.
Especially with the kids. So.
Yeah, absolutely. Talk to me a little bit. How did your season go this year?
I always have a good time, and along the way, I seem to fill a couple tags. That's the icing on the cake to me. I just love spending time out there, and you know, that's where it is. Killed a bull in Montana. Killed a whitetail in Montana this year. I typically don't put a lot of time into that, and I had a couple extra days and found some archery only areas that you didn't have to compete against the firearm guys, and went out there just to more or less just check it out. And in the first day I was there, I ended up killing one from the ground. He came by me at 4 yards, white tail. So that was pretty cool. Filled my antelope tag early in August as well. So that's
in Montana.
Yep. That's always an important one to me. I love to eat antelope. That's one of the family's favorites for freezer. space. Yeah. So
awesome, dude. Are you still playing the recurve game and trying to get it all done on, with a recurve?
I haven't for several years. I still have a couple, but yeah. The dedication and time it takes with traditional equipment, just, you know, you have young kids, it just isn't in the cards. It's one of those things where I'll probably go back to it eventually mm-hmm. because I really enjoyed it. But, and I catch a rash of shit from a lot of my traditional buddies. So, but it's fun. It's, I mean, it's always there. It's always there for something to go back to. So, yeah. But, I've been playing the compound game now. You know, I spent about a season and a half really putting the time in with the recurve. I had a great season and a half shooting animals with that. And then, you know, that obviously fell back into the compound side of it. I'm kind of techie and nerdy with that yeah. stuff and still have desire to get back to it. Just haven't yet. So
was that like a checkbox thing for you? Was that like, all right, I've killed elk with a compound. Was it kind of like, I just want to see if I can do it type deal. And then you did it. And now it's lost its interest.
No, I'd say the interest is still there, but it's yeah. not something that you can just pick up and shoot.
Right.
Like there's a muscle memory to it. It's a completely different experience. It's simplification. It's a lot of instincts and, you know,
yeah.
it's stuff that you need really good muscle memory with. And honestly, when I made the switch over to it, which it's been about 10 years now, I had some buddies that was equally as interested in trying something a little more challenging and something new. And honestly, like we got a crew of guys together that we were holding each other accountable.
Oh, nice. I like that.
We made a competition out of it. And I mean, that's more or less to just, you know, force us because it's easy to fall back into a compound. I mean, yeah. anymore, I don't shoot nearly as much as I'd like. I'm that stereotypical guy that, you know, I might shoot 600 arrows, 1,000 arrows with my hunting bow before season starts just to confirm marks.
Yeah.
And then I just go immerse myself in the, you know, where it takes me.
Yeah.
But I have muscle memory from years and years and years of shooting and competing at 3D shoots and repetition and stuff like that. So I don't know. It's like I said, it's still there. The desire to get back to that, there'll come a day when I go back and play around with that. But at the, you know, for the time being, it's, you know, it's been compound the last few years. So,
yeah. Talk to me, you know, okay. So obviously you got to learn a new weapon going from mm-hmm. compound and then you dabbled in it for that year, but talk and you got to educate your muscles and your form and all that stuff to get efficient with it enough to go out and try to kill an animal with it. So walk us through how the strategy from a compound hunting to, because you got it. Long story short, you got to get closer to the animal.
Yep.
Right. So walk us through how that changed as well.
You know, you can be more aggressive with, you know, compound equipment. And the getting close part is, I mean, with modern compound equipment, I mean, it's ridiculous. You know, I mean, yeah. we've all seen and heard, or maybe been to a total archery challenge shoot where, you know, the distances are, you know, far beyond what most people would shoot.
Yeah.
And the equipment is so good that you can actually make good shots. It's right. just the limitation and energy and stuff like that, you know, works against it. But I mean, we see it in the rifle side of things too. I mean, when it comes to, the equipment and, you know, all these gadgets that help us make the right dope call and stuff like that. I mean, guys are shooting animals at, you know, significantly longer distances than they ever have. So, yeah. But I guess to to go back to the question, it's you know, you got to make a commitment. You got to put the time in. And when it comes to getting close, like, you're starting your stock where you could typically kill with a compound when you're shooting traditional.
Gotcha.
You know, like 60, 70 yards is where you really got to start paying attention to stuff when it comes to getting close. And, I mean, I've done the prairie thing. I've done the mountain thing with deer, which is typically you're stalking a bedded animal that's stationary. And that's when you're putting on your padded, feet.
Yeah.
Gear to get in close. So, you know, that 100-yard mark, I mean, you could walk upright and not be super concerned depending on the conditions with how much noise you're making. And once you get to that 100-yard mark, then you got to start paying attention to stuff, little things like variability in the wind and how noisy the substrate you're stalking on is, you know, if it's grass, if it's gravel, you know, different objects make different noise. Some noises carry, some don't. And a lot of times with a compound, you can almost plop down there and then wait for them to make the next move. And I mean, that's being patient is what I've found to be the best, the best tool to be successful.
Did you change the environment in which you, like, for example, you killed an elk with traditional equipment, correct? Right.
Yep.
So did you go into like deeper, darker timber to try to get closer to them because there was more in between you, as opposed to a compound where maybe you went, you would have more open timber or more open meadow or something like that?
It comes down to knowing the pattern. I would say from compound to traditional equipment, I didn't really change what I do. You try to get in the zone with elk for me, and getting in the zone can be in a saddle. It could be in a, an area adjacent to a bedding area, something like that. I mean, a lot of people try to get into the zone or will move in and then try to press further. And that's where you blow it up. You got to know when to hold up, stop, and then let things play out. And I think guys get excited with calls. There's a place for calls. I think calling works in scenarios that are good for calling. Yeah. But I think when you're talking certain scenarios, if you know the habits of the elk and you can get into the zone and let things play out, an animal passing through, not on alert, not looking for somebody, not in a defensive position, is going to come through and offer a better opportunity than something coming in, looking for you. So, So I wouldn't say I changed much there. It's you can definitely immerse yourself in different, scenarios from a openness standpoint, but obviously further the animal is away, the less likelihood of being detected you are.
Yeah.
The less conscious of your scent you have to be, but you also got to make the shot and everything else. And, you put yourself in a scenario where you're on the edge of an open meadow with traditional equipment and it's 60 yards across that open meadow. They've got to come to your third of that meadow to make the shot. So you want to, you push it a little more to get close. So
yeah, I feel that. Okay. All right. I got a lot of questions for you today about your Western journey and things like that. But before we get into today's episode, I do want to send a huge shout out to our partners of the Western Rookie Podcast. First is Montana Decoy. If you are looking for a lightweight, very packable, high definition print decoy, go check out their antelope, their elk, their cows. They have cows that help you get closer to wild game. They have deer, they have turkeys. It's turkey season's coming up here pretty soon. And so go check out montanadecoy.com and check out their full lineup of decoys. Next on the list is Wasp broadheads. A majority of their heads are still manufactured in the United States and from some of the best material. I personally have been using Wasp heads now for several years. I shot my Western whitetail with Wasp. I've shot my Western mule deer with Wasp. And long story short, they destroy whatever they hit. I love those heads. Go check out wasparchery.com and enter the discount code NFC20 for 20% off. All right. Before we started recording here, you mentioned that you used to live in Minnesota and then you moved to Montana. What was it, 20 years ago?
Yeah, it's been 20 years now.
Okay. So what was the draw out west? Why leave Minnesota to go to Montana?
Well, the mule deer was actually the first thing that kind of got my Western hunting itch going.
Yeah.
I hunted the Dakotas from Minnesota. I would drive out, you know, to the western part of North and South Dakota and just playing in that open country. It was so different than sitting in a tree stand.
Mm-hmm.
The vast amounts of public land, the fact that there were fewer hunters, less pressure, is what drew me to the West. And I mean, I would end up even close to the country that I would deer hunt in, and I just get giddy inside about it. And I kind of said to myself, I'm like, what am I doing? You know, what am I doing? Minnesota's a great state. It's got a lot of opportunities. You got, you know, bear at the time, you could get bear tags really easily. You know, great whitetail. I spent quite a bit of time in Southeast Minnesota where, you know, we're right across. I've hunted like Buffalo County, Wisconsin and mm-hmm. some of those great counties down in Southeast Minnesota for deer, and the potential and opportunity to shoot really nice whitetails is huge, but it's a who you know game because it's mostly private.
Yep.
And just the ability to point yourself in a direction and walk for miles on land that you can mess around on, that's, you know, your and my land, that's public mm-hmm. land, just huge draw for me. So I made the move, and I never looked back. My first year out there, I did all the planning. I actually, before I even became a resident, I drew a non-resident tag in Montana. So I'm like, this is awesome. Like, I get to hunt my first year here.
Yeah.
And, I killed a bull, my first year there, not knowing what the hell I was doing. I was 9 miles into a wilderness area from the trailhead. And the guy that I went with had more experience than me from a hunting standpoint, but it was a situation where a little bit of panic set in, more so on his part than mine. If I remember correctly.
So you were just a little clueless of what just happened. Yeah.
I was like, you know, we hiked in, we got to the trailhead at like 3 a.m. and we're just going to day hunt. And we just started walking up the trail, and it's a steep draw. You know, it's really steep on both sides. And we hiked in, we kept hiking in, and, you know, 3 hours later, we're in the middle of nowhere, we're sitting on a ridge, we're eating lunch, and 3 o'clock in the afternoon, some elk started bugling further in.
Yeah.
So we, let's go check it out. And we drop in and kind of get into this herd. And I remember the first visual experience I had close quarters. It was real tight timber. It was real thick.
Yeah.
And I was like, these things are freaking huge.
Yeah.
And like, people have heard the term like forest horses. That's literally like what it felt like. Like, it was like you couldn't see 40 yards.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think I had three bulls come in on that same set. It was a a herd of cows that obviously had a herd bull that was sorting things out with other bulls. It was like the second week of September. And the bull I ended up killing came in and started raking a tree at like 30 or 40 yards. And I didn't have a shot. I could just see, you know, tines moving around, you know, trees yeah. swaying and stuff. And as he was getting ready to leave, I was able to slip an arrow through a tight lane. And he didn't know what happened. Yeah. You know, he jumped and went about 10 or 15 yards and stood in one spot for a minute or two. And then he disappeared. So I went back. I worked back to the friend of mine that was with me and talked to him. We went down and an entire sapling, you know, fir tree that was, you know, 2 feet tall was just covered in like foamy blood and froth and, you know, good blood. It was all deadfalls and lodge poles. So it was like a pain in the butt to like navigate. And we followed it several hundred yards and then we followed it into an opening and then it worked up into a thick spot and we followed it and bumped it and it ran across this meadow and it was bleeding really good. It was a low hit. It was a low cavity hit right behind the shoulder and it like clipped a lower lobe of a lung, something of that sort, enough to continue to bleed really well.
Yeah.
And we followed it and then, you know, this again started at about 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon and, you know, we gave it some time and then we followed it up and it was in a bed dying and couldn't get out of the bed and I shot it again and there we stood as the sun was setting and 9 miles from the trailhead. And, you know, things change when it gets dark and you're off a Forest Service trail by a couple miles and everything else. So that was my first experience elk hunting. In a scenario where, you know, I got into them and was able to make a shot. And it was like, I think most people, it would turn them off to the point of never wanting to do it again because it was a fiasco for 3 days trying to get back in there and get everything. Because we broke that elk down. We hung it from the trees. Didn't have, you know, all the game bags and stuff that I needed, but it was cool. So I just hung them away from the carcass in the trees and didn't lose any meat to spoilage. Yeah. A bear had found the head and I had caped it out like I was going to get it shoulder mounted and everything. Yeah. It was a decent bull. And a bear ate the nose off the head and tore up the hide and everything. So, but we went back. I went back in there the day after with a guy with horses, and we didn't get to the trailhead till mid to late morning. So we didn't end up back there until after dark. Like 9 miles is a long ways to go, especially off trail.
Yeah,
we were probably 7 miles in on trail and then 2 miles off trail, and it was too thick and whatnot to get the horses in there. And I had pins on a GPS, but it was a north slope. It was thick timber and we got in there and it was raining and those old Garmin GPSs back in the day, you get cloud cover and thick timber and you'd lose service and you wouldn't be able to get your exact pinpoint location like you could. But we went in there and didn't find it with horses in the dark, tracked all the way out. And then I convinced two other guys to walk in with me if they could hunt. And I'm like, absolutely, man. I'm going to pack a shotgun because it's in grizz country.
Yeah.
And, you know, hearing all the stories from guys, oh yeah, pack a shotgun. I had bear spray. I had a Mossberg 12 gauge, you know, not being very experienced that I didn't need that. But, it was just a scenario where it, like I think it would have broke most people. But it was just an adventure to me. And now I shoot them close to the road.
You learned your lesson, right?
Yeah. Yep. I mean, I've gone back into that country and I've hunted in that country and it's super cool back there. But like, it's as much a plan to get an animal out as it is to get in there to harvest an animal. It's a bigger plan. You need to have your ducks in a row.
Yeah.
And yeah, so that was like my first elk experience right there.
Okay.
So, as a rookie.
So did you, when you were living in Minnesota, that was your first elk experience, but was it, how many years were you hunting mule deer in the Dakotas before you moved to Montana?
I'd probably say 4 or 5.
4 or 5. Okay. All right.
So back then it was easier to get tags, and I'd buy an over the counter tag every year, and I'd spend, yeah. I'd go out there early and hunt early when it's really hot, mm-hmm. velvet bucks. And then I'd usually plan like a week over Thanksgiving, just with holiday break and everything. You'd get a big long stretch of days where you could go out and spend some time. And I'd go out in November and I'd stay in a hotel if it was cold. I've been out there and I'd tent it. Any long weekend in the entire fall, I would try to plan a way to get out there. And it was like 7-8 hours from the Twin City area where I live to get out there. And, you know, I've got some friends that still hunt in the same areas that I hunted in. And, I don't know. I've kind of been wanting to go back and just check it out because it's changed a lot. So,
yeah. Back then, I think that residents in the Dakotas, they could hunt September 1 back then, right?
Oh, yeah. Yep.
Yeah.
Non-residents you can't, could too.
Yeah. That's what I meant. I'm sorry. Non-residents could hunt September 1. I think, I can't remember when my first year of doing that was, but I think my first year ever, we went before the change of October 1 for non-residents, especially in South Dakota. So, dude. And so kind of going back to that elk hunt, what was something you learned with that first elk experience that you've kind of taken with you every other year since then?
I don't know. The guy I was with was great, but he was married. I was single. Like he kind of like, he had different lists of responsibilities, and I think mentally he was pretty nervous about where we were in the dark as far back as we were. I think picking people to be in the mountains with in scenarios like that is important. I'm very good with the flow. And he said, no, we got to go. We got to get out of here. Like we didn't pack anything out that night. That's how nervous he was.
From bears or just the
bears,
dark?
Bears, time standpoint. I mean, you put a quarter on your back and you're operating at about half speed.
Yeah.
You know, especially in downhill. You know, it's like you don't want to go too fast because you can mess yourself up pretty easily.
Yeah.
And he literally, like, we got it quartered, we got everything going, and then we started on our way out, and we were going so slowly that he just like, no, we got to get out of here. It was like 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock, and we're not even to the Forest Service trail.
Yeah,
where there's 7 more miles to go. So he was like, oh man, you know, we need to get out of here. You know, his wife is going to be worried about him, yada, yada, yada. And I understand that. But at the same time, it's like, okay, we didn't have the devices that we have now. We didn't have InReach, we didn't have the Zoleos, stuff like that you can actually communicate with, you know? So that would have been, you know, helpful in that scenario, because we could have taken our time, gotten half of it out, staged it in an easy to find location. What it was, we went down draw into dark, thick north face timber. And then he was like, we gotta go. So picking somebody that can stay composed.
Yeah.
And it wasn't that he didn't stay composed. He just was in a worrisome scenario of the situation and the amount of time and stuff like that.
Is that because he had been there before and maybe you hadn't, and plus you were young and you're like, I don't care what the scenario is, I'm going type of deal?
I mean, I lived in Montana alone. Like I didn't have a girlfriend. I had a roommate that, you know, half the time he never knew where I was anyway. Like I had a few friends, and it was actually a core group of work guys that I moved out there with.
Yeah.
And, it was just a panic situation on his part. Yeah. And he panicked a little bit because he knew that we probably wouldn't be out till 3 o'clock in the morning if we would have hauled stuff out. So back to your question, good people, you know, people that you trust, people that you can be real with, like, and at the time, this guy was the same age as me. He was just, you know, a year or two older than me. He was actually my boss.
Yeah.
For the place of work that I worked at. So it's like, I can't tell him to like, no, screw you. We're going to do this. You know, it's like, it was just one of those scenarios where I was new to it. He had more experience in living in Montana for a longer period of time and stuff like that. And, but it was like, I'm the new guy. I can't like
quit. I got it.
Yeah. You know, so this, I just kind of went with the flow and it was fine. Like it all came out. I made friends with a guy that had horses and continued to be friends with him. And these other two guys that ended up, you know, 3 days later going back in there and helping me.
Yeah.
Are still guys that I see from time to time and have memories with, and they're good guys too. So it's, I mean, and I'm still, you know, I haven't talked to the guy that I had actually hunted with, but I mean, it would be like nothing to, you know, run into him and have a really long conversation about where we've been and what we've what we've seen together and stuff. So I mean, no hard feelings anyway to any of those, but it was just like that was kind of the thing that that I took out of it is like, okay, so I gotta make sure I pick the right guys. And for several years after that, I've got a really good friend that lives in Minnesota that came out with me and hunted with me. And then my cousin came out and hunted with me a bunch too. Both have been, you know, on the distracted side with growing families and stuff like that. You know, like we discussed earlier, but it's one of those things where, you know, you immerse yourself in that. You want to be surrounded by people that you can sit down and have a good, like solid problem solving situation and figure it out and be on the same page. So,
yeah, my first elk hunt ever, was in Idaho, and I was game, right? I did my workout, like I lifted weights basically, right? Mm-hmm. I didn't do any rucking or anything like that to prepare myself. And I think, I don't want to say we had some bad weather, but at the same time, the elk were deeper and further than they had been previous years for the guy that I was with. Okay. And so it was a bad experience because of the weather. I was not prepared gear wise and the fact that I was not in shape enough to keep up with him because he had more backcountry experience than me. And so I felt like I was an anchor the entire time on that trip. So from your perspective, and then from my perspective, I just felt horrible because I was just keeping this guy was always looking back, trying to make sure I was keeping up with him. And, you know, I learned a lot of lessons on that particular hunt as far as how to acclimate to higher elevation, the gear, the boots, like all that stuff. I learned a lot of hard lessons through suffering basically in that. And then one of those is, like what you were saying, was to try to find people who match with you, not only from the intensity level of where you're at, as far as how deep you're willing to go or how late you're willing to stay versus, just being in shape enough to help you pull an elk out after you shoot it. Some people just wouldn't be able to do that.
No, it's definitely, I mean, you see the, just from an industry perspective, you see the physical fitness side of it.
Yeah.
It's very heavy in the elk space. Just because of the terrain, the high elevation, the, all that stuff. I'm fat and not in very good shape, but when it comes to the hunting season and how I hunt, I lose 20, 25 pounds during the hunting season, and I don't kill bulls 9 miles from a trailhead anymore. Yeah. That was a one-time thing. And, I think it's there's some truth. You have to have the right mental state, I think, or you need the physical fitness to know your limitations and to not like burn your reserves.
Yeah.
Like I do a ton of observing when it comes to my hunting style. I'm not charging into basins. I'm not doing anything. I'll find a good glassing knob that I can get to, and I spend a lot of time looking. And
yeah,
I think that's overlooked a lot. And knowing when to jump in.
Yeah.
I'll give you an example. Like this year's elk that I killed this year, I think I killed him on like the 17th of September. We opened on the 6th.
Yeah.
And I put my camp in, up in the mountains, droves of people with a late open. Like you don't have that pressure that's spread out over the first 2 weeks of September. You're cutting loose on the 6th of September. All of a sudden you lost a week in September that you can hunt. Yeah. And September is magic, and it can be the first day of September. It can be the last day of September. It doesn't matter. But so that all the individuals that were hunting the area that I was hunting, public land, were basically that first week was gone because of how late the open was in Montana this last year. And for the first 6 days of the season, the end of one of the roads, the two tracks, had anywhere from 2 to 4 side-by-sides, four-wheelers, whatever it may be, every single day for the first week. There were multiple camps. I knew there were elk in that basin because that basin, you know, that the trail falls into that basin, and the trail goes down into the basin. It doesn't, you know, go along the rim or anything like that. So those individuals were all hunting in one basin that was probably a mile to mile and a half across. And, you know, shortly into the basin, you're 1,000 yards or 1,000 vertical feet down into it. So those guys were all hunting into that basin and stirring the elk up and doing what they do. And on the Monday following opening weekend, so this is like day 9 of the season, there was nobody. Day 10 of the season, there was nobody. On that 13th or day of the season, there was also nobody. So I'm like, okay, now I can go in there. And I'd seen a couple bulls in there that were, you know, stuff that I wanted to hunt. I'd gone elsewhere because there were people there. You know, yeah, there's reason to put myself in a scenario where I'm competing for a bull. And on that day, 3 days after nobody'd been in that base, and that bull was, one of the bulls that I was after in there was 600 yards from that trailhead, bedded in a spot they like to bed. Like I've got pictures and video of him like sleeping, like literally like eyes closed, barely holding his head up, kind of nodding off. He had like 10 or 12 cows. I made a play on him that day and actually boogered them down the basin. And the following day, he had a chip on one of his royals. He had about 2 inches broke off, so he was easy to spot. Just a classic 6-point, nothing fancy. Like a mile and a half down the basin the next evening, he was coming up on the opposite side in the sage with right around the same amount of cows. And then that next morning I worked down into that draw as he was coming back. He was bugling in the dark and he had attracted the attention of a couple other bulls and he was fighting them off. And I intercepted him in the bottom, coming back to the same spot I boogered him 2 days before. So, I mean, they run these little loops where if they're pressured, they move out and then they kind of move back. I don't have to be in there to know that. It's a lot of it's experience in the terrain and how the animal work and the pressure. But, I mean, that bull was, when I killed him, was less than a mile from the trailhead. The last 2 or 3 bulls I've killed, like I think the last 4 bulls all inside of a mile. Like,
yeah,
some of them are it's easier to you know, to say in yards how close they were to where you could get a vehicle.
Yeah.
And then all public land, this is no permissions to cross, no nothing. And I think guys get obsessed with going deep. Honestly, get to a spot you can observe or listen, have two or three of these spots that you can go to check, and then put your time in that way. And I'm no better than any, you know, the average guy. I think I just spend more time out there, you know, with flexibility with work. When I put myself on the mountain, I put myself where, you know, I'm using the technology that we have now at our disposal to, communicate with, you know, my colleagues and make sure my job is taken care of. Working remotely definitely is helpful. And having the flexibility to hunt in the morning and hunt in the evening and then take care of your work obligations during the day, even when you're on the mountain, it kind of forces you to slow down. You're at a walking pace. There's no running, no, none of that. So,
yeah. How many years, and maybe cause that first elk story, 9 miles deep, like you, I'm trying to put myself in your shoes and go, like, I don't know if I would have been able to make it or finish it. You know what I mean? Like, it would have maybe taken me 5 days or whatever the case is. And it, like, unwinding. How over the years have you figured out what your limit is? Because let's just say it was daylight 24 hours a day and you didn't get tired and you could hunt all day and any, you could go back 100 miles if you wanted to, right? But you still got to come back to the truck. How did you find out what your limits were or how to hunt elk that were closer to the trailheads in the roads and still be successful?
I think it's just time in the field. You know, when I broke into the field of work that I'm in now, it opened up into having the ability to really look at knowing when to put yourself into the scenario. Like,
yeah,
it, you become an observer, and there are times when elk move day, you know, in the mornings and in the evenings, throughout the year. It doesn't matter if you're scouting or if you're hunting. And if you put yourself, you can't sleep in, you can't. You know, those critical hour before light and into light, and then the hour before, you know, the sun sets, is when the activity happens. That's when you're going to get all your data points, your information on how animals are moving and what they're doing. And, honestly, the ability I don't miss a morning. I don't miss an evening. I'll skip all day, you know, to rest and recover until I start to see the activity levels that I need to see during the middle of the day.
That warrant you going in.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay.
I'm not, you know, and, you know, that's probably the best way to, like, I don't go in on herds unless there's a bull I'd kill in it. You know, that's another thing too. Like, I don't pass hundreds upon hundreds of elk every year to kill what I've killed. I'm very fortunate to be as successful as I've been. But at the same time, it's like, if I'm just watching from the sidelines and the goal line is within sight and the scenario makes sense, to put yourself into that scenario to be successful, you know, you have to be within striking distance. You know, you leave yourself out. So there's no chance, no possible way that, you know, that you're going to screw up the animal's movement. And then when you can make that last dash in and immerse yourself into that movement pattern or scenario that's happening.
Yeah.
That's where I've been able to find my success. So it's more patience than just finding yourself with an elk walking by. I mean, it's knowing when to when to jump in there and when to do it. So
how often, because of maybe terrain or maybe they're working away from you, or maybe it's weather, like you could throw just about any scenario in there. How often are you walking away from bulls or leaving a bull to, because you are just like, maybe it's too far, maybe the weather's going to turn, and you've learned over the years that I don't want to end up 9 miles away from the trailhead.
There have been scenarios where it's, you know, they're there for a reason. If you know where they want to be, that's what you need to learn. If they want to be in a particular spot, that's key information to have. I mean, if an elk is in a particular spot and they have what they need, there's no reason for those elk to leave that spot.
Yeah.
So if they like that spot, eventually you put a plan together to intercept in that spot or get to that spot.
Yeah.
But I think it's key to put all the data points together before you make a move. You know, I mean, the more information you have, the more calculated your process is going to be. I mean, I remember, this will be another example, like glassing from a big vantage point on a mountain, having a big closure in an area due to a fire,
mm-hmm.
that you couldn't go through it. And there was ways to walk through it on a, like a Forest Service trail or a Forest mm-hmm. Service road, being like 7, 8, 9 miles from an elk
mm-hmm.
or a herd of elk and watching them do the same thing for a couple days straight in the same opening. It's like, I could get there, but I have to come off the mountain I'm on, go out and around this closure area, come up the other way. And I did that
mm-hmm.
and I got in there and I found a bull that had been gored by another bull that was dead, but the elk had actually moved off by the time I got there because it took me too long to get to move.
Yeah.
I thought that they were going to stay in that same pattern, you know, after watching them for a couple days there. So like there isn't a too far or anything like that in my mind. If you can put the pattern together, it's just, you need to have the right reinforcements that are willing to back you up.
Yeah.
To help with an extraction if you're successful. And it would have been all downhill and it would have been, you know, 2.5 miles if I would have killed a bull, but it was,
mm-hmm.
it was a bull that was worth going back into to get. And I wasn't successful, but I mean, you're going to learn more from failures than you are successes. Yeah. Most times. So,
yeah. So, you know, the point of this podcast when we originally created it was to try to educate people who are coming from the East to hunt species like antelope, mule deer, and elk that are, that don't have access to them in their own states, right? Like Iowa, I just got whitetails and turkeys, man, and, you know, pheasants and whatever. But if I want to hunt an elk, I got to go west. If I want to hunt mule deer, I got to go west, right? And so a lot of times, based off of what it sounds like you're doing, is you like to kill them close to the road, but you don't have a problem going further because you know you can make a couple phone calls and have some buddies or a team of horses come in and help with the extraction. What advice would you then give to a 2-man crew coming from Pennsylvania or whatever, all the way across the country to go hunt elk, that they may not be aware of when stepping out into the backcountry for the first or even second, third, fourth time?
Don't think that you have to go way in deep
to
kill something.
Yeah.
You know, the length of time that you have is going to be critical to play into how I hunt. Mm-hmm. Not a lot of people have that luxury, have the time. And I'll tell you that the guys that are successful consistently out there aren't weekend warriors.
Right.
If that tells you anything. They're not spending 10 days on a hunt. they're spending 20 plus days. You know, I've befriended some guys up on the mountain from the Midwest that I look forward to seeing when they draw tags and come out, and they come out for 20 plus days a year.
Yeah.
And if time allows, you're not spending money when you're on the mountain. You're spending money getting there.
Yeah.
If you can make a comfortable camp and put more time and energy into hunting a little easier, don't kill yourself to the burnout point, you're going to find more enjoy, you know, a more enjoyable hunt, and you're going to be more successful. And not everybody can do that with families and jobs and certain scenarios, but I mean, I'm not that great a hunter. I just have more time than most people.
Yeah. Time kills animals, dude.
Yeah.
I mean, across all species.
Yep.
Yeah.
If you have a job that's a shift job and you can take that middle week off and have a week at the beginning and a week at the end of a shift.
Yeah.
Man, take as many days as you can get there, and you don't need to put yourself into the mix, like into animals the day you get there. You need to try to find a pattern, exploit a pattern, find the animals. That's the hardest thing.
Yeah.
You know, not having boots on the ground beforehand. You know, you can do a lot with e-scouting and stuff anymore that really helps, you know, saddles, things of that nature. You know, finding movement patterns, you know, where elk go when they're pressured, how they move about, how long it takes them to get back. You know, that type of information is invaluable when it comes to that stuff. And honestly, like, if you go in with the mindset that, you know, it's not a competition, you know, like I told you this, the bull this year, like I didn't even go into the basin I wanted to go into because it was overrun with people. When you talk about a mile wide and a 3 mile long basin that everybody's accessing from the same point, you have four different vehicles. I don't know how many people were in each vehicle, but there's four modes of transportation parked at this trailhead.
Yeah.
That goes into this area. In elk bugles, you're going to have four different teams of people, be it individual, be it multiple, that are going to converge on the same animal, and nobody's going to win. Like it's going to be who's going to get to it first to spook it.
Right.
So, and I think that's important, you know. I mean,
how often do you have a scenario like that? And this just popped into my head. You are competing for that bull. Mm-hmm. Maybe there's a bull that you really want. You know, there's another two or three guys in there hunting it. How often are you trying to flank that and plan on somebody making a mistake so they push it towards you instead?
Knowing the escape routes is huge. Like knowing what an elk does when they're pushed or bumped. Do they go up the mountain? Do they go down the mountain? Do they do whatever? You know, I was on a Forest Service trail when I was literally within 200 yards of a highly used Forest Service trail by hikers, like not hunters, by recreational hikers, trail runners, things of that sort that use the area that I had that success this year in. And I was within 200 yards of that. So they're commonly seeing people and scent in that location. And that kind of, you know, is I think why that herd moved back to that same area within a day and a half. And that's why I know when there's other people in there, I just don't even mess with it, because it doesn't take long to get back to being where it was. You know, all summer long, those animals are affected by the human traffic, and they almost get used to it to an extent. So,
what's one thing, you know, the scenario I said of the guys coming out west and maybe they may dedicate a week. That's usually what I do: a day of driving, 6 days of hunting, and then a day of driving back. Okay. What's, even when I went out and failed, you know, because I failed every time. I have never killed an elk with my bow yet. What's one thing that a non-resident should take away from, you know, if they're coming from the East to the West, what's one or two things that they should try and take away from every trip like that so that the next time they come in, whenever they draw their tags, they're better prepared or educated about elk hunting?
The more you can learn an area, the better. I think the more apt to be successful you're going to be. And if going back to hunt the same area, you know, generationally, you know, an elk in the wild, a 10-year-old elk is a very old elk. So you got to think that, you know, they're learning this stuff from the, you know, the matriarchal cow or bull within the group that they're in. And once you kind of exploit a pattern, that pattern is not just a one animal pattern in most cases.
Yeah.
That's a generational thing that's passed on. Mm-hmm. The use of certain areas during the rut, the use of certain wallows, certain things. And honestly, the more time you spend in a given area, the better off you are. You don't need to necessarily be subjective to like a highly coveted tag. Yeah. Because I think a lot of opportunities in the West have quality animals outside of, you know, those coveted tags that are there. You know, they learn to cope with the pressures that be. And, I mean, one of my biggest elk came from a general unit. So, there's no tag to draw. It was an area that you can get every year, general area. And, you know, if you want a more like elite level, like experience, I think if you look at like the top 10% of the limited entry units, you can definitely put yourself in that. And there's no reason to not, strive for that. But a general area, putting your time in, learning the area is going to be best suited to the 7-day hunter efficiency. A family vacation out there. A lot of times, like, tags for bear are easier to get. If you want to double down on a particular area, get a bear tag. You know, in Idaho or Montana or Wyoming, you get a bear tag and you go out, maybe not in the, you know, you're not putting yourself at high likelihood to be successful there, but if you have the time and the means, boots on the ground in an area are going to tell you a lot more than anything you can read or somebody else can tell you, because you're going to learn more. And honestly, if you're serious about it and being successful, if you can, you know, do like a 5-day bear hunt in the spring and then go back and when you have a fall tag, like a bull tag or whatnot, putting that time in, you're just going to better your chances.
Compound your chances. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
So,
well, cool, man. I mean, you kind of got me fired up a little bit about elk hunting again. I got a lot of points for Wyoming that I'm going to have to. I got a knee replacement surgery coming up in March. So all of my non-resident hunts are at a halt until I get that knee healed up and I'm back to being able to carry, you know, weight on it again and start doing my ruck hikes and stuff like that. So I got a year, if not a little more, of, you know, getting back on the horse, so to speak, and getting that leg back to where it needs to be. But when I do, I'm going to start cashing in some points here in for my Wyoming preference points that I have stacked up, and I'm really looking forward to it. So dude, thank you very much for taking time out of your day to hop on and just talk with us about your experiences elk hunting and what you've learned and what you do and what you, you know, like your, a little bit of your strategy and your thought process there. And dude, I really appreciate you taking time today to talk with us.
Absolutely, man. It's good to catch up.
Yeah, you too, man.
You saw the game-winning play once, but have to replay it 3 times on the way back to the hotel. Because some moments don't end at the buzzer. Life's a trip. Make the most of it at Best Western. Book direct and save at bestwestern.com.
How many discounts does USAA Auto Insurance offer? Too many to say here. multi-vehicle discount, safe driver discount, new vehicle discount, storage discount, legacy.
How many discounts will you stack up? Tap the banner or visit usaa.com/autodiscounts. Restrictions apply.
This episode is brought to you by Peloton. Break through the busiest time of year with the brand new Peloton Cross Training Tread Plus. Powered by Peloton IQ. With real-time guidance and endless ways to move, you can personalize your workouts and train with confidence, helping you reach your goals in less time. Let yourself run, lift, sculpt, push, and go. Explore the new Peloton Cross Training Tread Plus at onepeloton.com.
President's Day savings are happening now at the Home Depot with up to 40% off select appliances. Looking to upgrade your fridge? Check out LG's newest model, serving up ice in all kinds of styles. Cube, crushed, craft ice, and now new mini craft ice straight from the dispenser. From cold brew to fizzy favorites, these refrigerators will have you entertaining like a pro. Shop President's Day savings and get up to 40% off, plus free delivery on select appliances like LG at the Home Depot. Free delivery on appliance purchases of $1,498 or more. Offer valid February 5th through the 25th, U.S. only. See store online for details.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.